my calculations are correct, when this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious shit.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
It's showtime.
Right, welcome everybody to another episode of the VHS Strikes Back. I am one of your hosts, Chris, and my co-host, I'm a very good friend, he's Dave.
Hey there, Chris, and hello to all listeners out there. Welcome to the VHS Strikes Back, the show where we dust off the old video player and go on a nostalgic journey to look at the good and the bad movies of yesteryear. Now, Chris, we've got some special guests this week. Who have we got?
Well, Dave, we have the wonderful Mr. Tony Farina and an even more wonderful Mr. Max Byrne, both from, Dave, your other podcast. So can you introduce it, as this is a special crossover episode?
Well, I'm not sure how you just ranked our two guests there. But,
I agree. You know, I would say that equally wonderful. It's because in the draft episode, Max beat me. And so Max is better.
Well, first of all, yes, so it is a crossover episode, so we thought we'd do a crossover with the Mandatory Marvel and CD podcast, and welcome to the show, Tony, first.
Hello, hello. Happy to be here. I know our guests can't see, but obviously, below my camera line, I am greased up and sweaty, and I have my saxophone. I'm ready to go.
Awesome. Well, yeah, what an intro there. And Max, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm absolutely delighted to be here to finally reappear on this magnificent show to discuss an absolute classic 80s film ahead of our crossover edition of Mandatory Music and CD next week. So can't wait to talk about what is, in my opinion at least, one of the greatest films of the 80s.
Awesome. Wow. I don't think we've actually introduced it. I mean, if you look at your podcatcher, it will say, but Chris, what are we actually going to review today?
Well, we're going back to 1987, and this film, Dave, is a cult classic, I think. And this one is The Lost Boys, starring Kiefer Sutherland, and I'd probably say Jason Patrick as well, Corey Haim, Corey Feldman, some classics from the 80s. So, yeah, I'm quite looking forward to this because I've only ever seen it once, and I remember really, really enjoying it first time around. And I got late to the party, sort of mid-90s, I think I watched it. So, yeah, I'm interested on this one.
Now, coming to you, Max, first, what are your kind of early memories of this one?
Well, it came out in 1987, so I was only 8 years old when it came out. So obviously nowhere near old enough to see it when it was released, and nor should you at that age. So I would say probably about age 11 or 12 when I first watched it on VHS at a friend's house. I'd heard of it by reputation. Some kids at school had said they'd seen it and what a great film it was. So obviously I was chomping at the bit to see it. I'd seen the VHS case in the video shop as well, but obviously when it came out, obviously too young to see it. But when I finally did, it just blew me away. It's just a vibrant, exciting, colourful film that, in my opinion, at least still holds up today.
Very good. And how about yourself, Tony?
Well, as the old man of the team, this came out in July, on July 31st, 1987 in America. So it was the summer between what we call middle school and high school, which I know is different for you guys. So I was 14. I just turned 14 that summer when the movie came out, and this was everywhere. Everybody saw it. It was the whole thing. So that whole last month, like, we start school at the end of August. So like those 3 weeks before, everybody was talking about The Lost Boys. I saw it several times in the theater. I had a Lost Boys poster. Of course, I had the soundtrack, which is why we're doing this crossover episode. So, I mean, you couldn't get away from this film. It was, I think, the like 1987, you know, in that time frame, end of eighth grade, going, it was like Beastie Boys, License to Ill, Appetite for Destruction, Lost Boys. Like, those were the things, like, that eighth grade freshman year for me, this crossover thing. So it was that big of a deal. In the zeitgeist of my life. And I will admit to having quite a bit of a crush on Ms. Gertz. So that was also very exciting to see her not do very much. She has very little to do in this film, but I didn't know that at the time when I went to see it. So that's my memory of it.
Seeing basically it the only time. Woman apart from the mum in the movie. But
is Jamie. Yeah.
So I think for myself, I saw this, it must have been about 88, so I'd have been about 12 at the time. And a little bit like last week's, which you haven't heard yet, but The Fly came out the same year, and it kind of sits in my mind around the same space. So it was kind of a horror movie, but it was something that at 12 years old didn't scare the crap out of me. So I quite liked it just for that. But the other emotion, if you like, that I remember from watching it for the first time is just, I thought Kiefer Sutherland was just the biggest dick on the planet, and not in a positive way that might sound. So yeah, I just thought he was an utter bastard. And I don't know if I've ever really got over that. I still think he's a bit of a prick, even though he's probably a lovely bloke. But yeah, so I haven't watched it too much since then. I certainly not since the early 90s have I seen this again. So when we discussed it.
And he played Ace in Stand By Me. So he had a run of playing huge cocks.
Oh, he was just a dick, like I say, you know. So I know he was a hero in 24 and stuff later on, but I think he was a little bit typecast, wasn't he? Just a bastard, basically. But yeah, so I was quite looking forward to coming back to this one. And obviously next week we'll cover the album as well. So we're recording next week, but it will come out the week after, I think.
It's all timey-wimey. Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll come out around about the same time. So we'll discuss the album as well. But I mean, music is massive in this movie, isn't it? So it seems right that we would cover both of those. Now, guys, should we get into the trailer?
Let's go.
Yeah. Oh, there he is. Oh.
Michael and Sam have just moved to Santa Carla, California. They're about to discover its secret.
Notice anything unusual about Santa Carla yet?
No. It's a pretty cool place. If you're a Martian.
Or a vampire.
When you're strange.
Your brother, Sammy, help me!
Stay back! Stay back!
What's happening to me, Star?
Get yourself a good sharp stick. Drive it right to his heart.
You're a vampire, Michael!
My own brother, a damn blood-sucking vampire!
Oh, you wait till Mom finds out, buddy!
When a vampire buys it, it's never a pretty sight.
Michael, they're coming! Oh, shit!
Michael Emerson and his younger brother Sam move to their recently divorced mother Lucy's fictional small-town beach of Santa Clara, California, to live with her eccentric father, Michael, and Sam's grandfather. Michael and Sam hang out at the boardwalk, which is plastered with flyers of missing people. Lucy gets a job at a video store owned by bachelor Max Lawrence. Michael becomes fascinated with Star, a beautiful young girl he spots on the boardwalk, though she seems to be with the mysterious David, the leader of a youth biker gang. Now, Chris, what do you reckon to the opening of this movie?
Got to be one of the most beautiful women in a film, Dave, I've got to say. 80s, I'd have been all over this character, definitely. Not literally, but, you know, just figuratively, obviously.
yeah, just from the front room.
We're not having one of my stories. I keep getting called out for that. So, no, I genuinely was excited about this. I thought, oh, here we go. And it's very strange, the Jim Morrison fascination in this movie. You'll have to explain more about this one, but I didn't remember that. But yeah, it starts off pretty well. However, I thought there was loads of like building up to it, plot twists, everything. Well, literally, Michael is literally in from the start. He is absolutely in. And I found that so quick, how that all happened. And he gets sort of ingratiated in the gang and everything. It's not what I remember at all. I thought it was like, he was up, I don't know why, up against them and that. So I was quite shocked how quickly, I know it's only 97 minutes, it moved along. So yeah, it's interesting. I've got plenty to say, but I don't want to spoil it for everyone else. But yeah, I was quite surprised how it just got into the plot. And Michael was just accepted into this gang with pretty much nothing other than going on a bike ride with a load of cloud.
Yeah. Tony, how about yourself?
Yeah, I too remember it taking a little bit longer to get there. It's maybe been 4 or 5 years since I watched it, probably longer. And so, yeah, I was like, oh, right, they don't fuck around. And they mess around with continuity a little bit. But yeah, no, I think it starts off really strong. I think the 1987 practical camera work, visual effects. I know you guys did Jaws recently, and you talked about how the camera does a lot of the work of the stuff. Mm-hmm. And Schumacher, you know, he knew what he was doing. This is peak Schumacher, and I know he goes on to do Bat Nipples and everything later, but this is him really showing why he was given the Batman movies later, is because he pulled this shit off. And so I really love the opening, the way that the camera work on the security guard, you know, that whole scene. So I was all in. I wish I could remember the first time I saw it, but rewatching it, I once I started going, I was like, oh fuck, that's right. There's no pause in this movie. So I loved it.
Absolutely. And how about yourself, Max?
I always thought that, is it Santa Carla? Yeah, the fictional town. It just looked like a great place to live, aside from the fact that you could be eaten by a pack of teenage vampire bikers at any point. That aside, yeah, it always just looked like a great place to live. When I was a teenager watching this, you know, it's like party every night, Tim Capello flexing his pecs, playing the saxophone on the boardwalk, you know, comic book shops, fairground rides. It just looked like the best place to be as a teenager. And it's one of those, you know, when you've grown up in the northwest of England, you think, oh, fucking, I'd love to live there. You know, it's just like a complete escapist opening. But I agree with what Chris says. Yeah, Michael just seems to, like, literally look at Star, and she's just like, yeah, yeah, I'll be yours if you want, you know, because she's kind of David's girl at Star. And just by a mere glance, all of a sudden, they're together. It's kind of weird. But yeah, I guess when you're that handsome, you can pull the birds like that.
True. I always had that problem. Anyway, sorry.
Time didn't do him that favour, though, did it? So if you look at the losers, it's true. A bit like the opening to Karate Kid, actually, isn't it? You know, young lad comes into a new town, steals someone's girlfriend. It was Johnny's in that scenario. But
another 80s icon.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, it did look fantastic, didn't it? But I was also surprised about just how quickly it got into it. And I could never really understand why the gang were so interested in getting Michael to join the gang, especially Kiefer Sutherland. Everything is like, come on, Michael. Come on, Michael. It's just constantly like, you know, just egging him on. Now, can we talk? Because you guys are a lot more familiar with this film than probably Chris and I. Can we talk about the homoerotic undertones of this?
Because we have to.
I have no idea coming into this, and I'm watching it, and I'm like, all right, this really is in your face. I mean, are the vampires, is it just all about coming out? And the younger brother is definitely, you know, signaling some of that stuff. But what is the backstory here?
It's my contention. Well, Joel Schumacher was gay, the late great Joel Schumacher. And I don't know. I mean, this is 1987, right? Height of the AIDS epidemic in America. You know, mm-hmm. people are still making awful AIDS jokes. And the line from my movie that I made you guys watch about the football season being over, they had nothing to offer. So I think that this is me doing what I do. But I think it's Schumacher making it okay. Like saying, like, it's, yes, you know, like, obviously there's tons of gay overtones and it's very homoerotic in all the ways, like the big blood orgy scene later, and they're all like moaning Michael's name the whole time while they're, you know, so I feel like, and there's the scene too, when like the greasy saxophone guy is up there and Michael's trying to look at Star and Sam's like moving it. He makes a face and he's like pushing his head back. No, look at the sweaty, greasy guy. Don't look at the hot girl. And so to me, this is just my take on it always, was it was just Schumacher trying to say, you know, this is okay. Like it can be normalized, as it were. It can work. In a film. I don't know. That could just be me, you know, projecting on what he was doing as an, I don't know if he was out. Max, was he out during his career, or was that not until towards the end of his life that we found out he was gay?
Who, Joel Schumacher?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure. I know when he was still alive, he said he'd slept to anywhere between 10,000 and 20,000 men.
So he must have been out then.
So so he must have been somewhat.
Is that
out.
Even possible? Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. He claimed he was sexually active from the age of 11. And he died, was he 60 or 70, perhaps, when he died of cancer? So he must have crammed in a lot. Like, you know, Every
no pun intended.
Unintentional pun.
Yeah. Every day a new guy, I guess. But you know, good luck to him. You know, that's it's quite
multiple.
Yeah, it's quite some run rate, isn't it? But I agree with Tony. There's and what you were saying. There's tons of gay subtext in it, like the David and Michael thing. I've seen interviews with Keith Sutherland where he says, in his eyes, it was like this homosexual kind of love story, like with David and Michael, even though there was Star involved, that David really was like had like fallen for Michael in the film. That's how Kiefer Sutherland read it off the page, and that's how he played it in his own mind. So yeah, it's all there if you look for it. Definitely, it's some of it's subtle, some of it's definitely not. But yeah, there's tons of it definitely in this film.
Yeah, because I feel like, I mean, that was definitely a kind of relationship there, wasn't there, between David and Michael. But the young brother, so Corey Hames was it, the way he's kind of dressed and he's got a picture of Rob Lowe, you know, up in the corner there. I was just wondering, is he just playing with us? Because certainly in the UK, we've come a long way since the 80s, but it wasn't kind of very much out there, you know, about being gay and homosexual and whatever. So I just wondered, it was very, very clear, but I just wonder in the 80s, were we all just completely ignoring this?
I think
and that was a way to get it out there.
I was 14 when this came out. And so, I mean, I didn't notice because, again, I was there for Jamie Gertz and the vampires. And so upon, obviously, further viewings, you're like, oh, man, Corey Haim is definitely, Sam is definitely gay. But you also have to remember, too, in the 80s, like the way he dressed, all of their bad mullets and all of that, like they're all in the biker gang. But Sam just kind of dressed like he went to the mall and went to Chess King and bought the clothes that were there. So I still feel like he looked like a, you know, 14-year-old boy from 1987. As a 14-year-old boy from 1987, I saw kids who looked like him. Now I dress more like the Frog Brothers, but because that's what we could afford. But yeah. I definitely think that was a, you know, and I think it could be a signal to the audience too. Is like they're on hard times, but they weren't always. I mean, Michael has a motorcycle, right? And they're moving. They have to move back in. So I almost feel like the way Sam is dressed, I agree with what you're saying, Dave, but I also think we're supposed to look at kind of the way that Sam dresses and the way that their mom dresses. Much nicer clothes than the grandpa or Michael. So I think they're supposed to be like signaling they're kind of fallen on harder times too. So, you know, because of the way that I could be, again, I'm always reaching.
I must admit, one of the things that I hadn't noticed or hadn't remembered from the first time of watching was just how prevalent comics were in this movie. It was a complete surprise to me, and obviously you got Corey Feldman in there putting on his best grown-up voice which was ridiculous, but I loved it. And you know, it was a proper old school comic book store, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a real store, you know. And I read somewhere the comic book that they give Sam, the vampire, you know, they give him the vampire comic book to so tell him that this is what you need to do to stay alive. It was a fake book made for the film, but the owner of the comic book store where they shot that, they gave it to him after the shoot, and he got all the cast members to sign it, and it's still there in that comic book now, and he charges people to have like a picture taken with it to this day.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's a
really
dream.
Good.
I would do that. That shop is amazing. I love that shop. And the fact that it's what an old dirty comic shop used to look like. This is what my comic shops used to look like. Just shit everywhere, you know, quarter bins. It's not like it is now. Like in the 80s, comic shops were, you know, people didn't know what they were doing. When Sam comes in and gives them the lecture about the way it's organized, I'm like, I know that guy. I've been to the shop. That guy's at the shop, you know.
So what do you guys think about how it evolves then? So Michael, you know, eventually gets befriended. He only wants to get his leg over with Star, to be honest. But, you know, they're trying to get him into the group and lure him in. And you get these little side clips, don't you? You see that shot of the couple, you know, with the roof of the car coming off, and it's like, you know, proper old school 50s almost horror. But what do you think of that, how it evolves? And, you know, you get the little the worms in the noodles and stuff like that?
I think for me, I reveal my hand here. So I didn't enjoy this like I thought I would watching it. I thought it was quite slow. And it's an hour. I actually timed this. It's an hour until we get to see a vampire. So it's all alluded to. Like you said, homoerotic stuff. And I think some great points. I like what you just said, Max, about the fact that there's still a comic there from the movie and everything. That's brilliant. But I don't know. I just felt he was really, really quick the way everything happened. And Michael didn't take any convincing to get with all these guys. You know, that weird bike race he had, like I said before. And then it just goes from there. Obviously, there's definitely questions to check the internet history of the comic book owner, you know, the guy who wants his mum. There's definitely suspect stuff going on there. But it's just, I don't know, I can't put my finger on it because I was really excited. But I think that's a good point, Dave, when I watched it this time, realising that you don't see fuck all but the camera work, and it's very convincing. But also, one thing that put me out the whole film this time was, don't you think Corey Feldman looks like a shrunk down Patrick Swayze out of Point Break? He's an absolute double of him. He looks like Patrick Swayze. He bought off Wish, doesn't he? A fucking cheapo version, like a lookalike they've got. He's an absolute double of him. And every time he come on screen, I'm just thinking, he's fucking Patrick Swayze's younger fucking long-lost brother. I don't know why. It just really took me out of the film.
He does. Yeah, he definitely has a look of him, doesn't he, with that mullet and everything. But I always thought the Frog Brothers, when I was a teenager, I wanted to be a... In fact, fuck it, I still do want to be a Frog Brother. They were just, like, so badass and so cool and just, you know, what teenage boy doesn't want to, A, work in a comic book shop and go around staking vampires on your spare time? They were just the biggest pair of badasses ever. I just, they're two of my favorite film characters to this day. I absolutely love the Frog Brothers.
I'm there. I said to Max, as we were texting each other back and forth yesterday, I was like, I'm ready to be the Edgar to your Alan Frog. I'm ready to come and be a Frog Brother with Max today. Because I knew we hadn't talked about it, but I just knew instinctively, I knew Max would be, look, because, you know, we're old school nerds, you know, and I know you are too, Dave, with comic shops. And there's just, they literally were every 12-year-old boy's it, right? You're like, I work at a comic shop. I get to dress like Rambo. That's what it was, Chris. He's doing the Rambo. That's First Blood Part 2, the red bandana and the green and everything. And I mean, when I was a kid, where I would go buy my comic books, mostly was like at old flea markets and shit when, you know, because we were broke. And you could, and this is true because the 70s and 80s, nobody gave a fuck. I had a Rambo knife, you know, like one of those survival knives I bought at a flea market for like $5. So it's like, I'm like, the Frog Brothers are just like living every kid's dream of, I agree. I love them. And I get what you're saying, Chris, that it's not, it was all intentional. They weren't supposed to do it. Plus, you know, budgetary reasons. This is a pretty big cast, but I think that payoff is worth it. It is a 1980s movie, but with a 1970s sensibility of we're going to wait. You know it's vampires. We know what's going on. We're teasing you, but we're going to make it worth it when you get there. And I don't know if it's worth it when we get there. I don't know. That'll be a, you know, I don't know how you guys feel about it. I was thrilled about it. But yeah, I agree with Max, man. To be a Frog Brother would be a dream. And so Max and I will be we are your Frog Brothers here. We're here.
The Frog Brothers.
they just light up the screen. Every scene they're in, they just elevate it. They are brilliant, you know. And they're so, like, the film is quite tongue-in-cheek, but they are deadly serious throughout. Like, deadly, deadly serious. And, you know, it's not like, it's almost like they're not in on the joke kind of thing. They're just great.
I think that's what gets it to work well, though, isn't it? I think if they were kind of winking at the camera kind of thing and, you know, playing it with the tongue in the cheek, it wouldn't work so well, but because they are so fully into it and taking this so seriously, you know, it's almost like Baywatch, isn't it? You know, you've got these lifeguards who are on the side, just criminal investigators. It's ridiculous, isn't it? You know, you've got these comic book nerds in a shop and they're hunting vampires in their spare time. Is that ridiculous? But it is funny for the movie. But I think for me, I struggle to think of it as a horror movie. I mean, I don't even know what genre I would put it in, but I mean, Chris and I are both shithouses when it comes to horror movies because we're so scared of them. But with this one, there's nothing really scary. You get some of the makeup is really good, you know, especially when Kiefer Sutherland gets when he turns and the little kid as well in particular. But nothing's really scary about it.
No, it's not, is it? There's not. It's all kind of inferred and done with clever, like you guys were saying, clever camera work. It's not really all out gore fest. Even at the end battle at the house, when vampires are getting killed left, right, and centre, it's never really massively explicit. I mean, there's a lot of blood in that, but it's not gory. It's definitely a comedy horror film, isn't it?
Well, I think that's it. I think it is. I would classify it as a work of satire. I think it's a horror movie. It's obviously, as we've already talked about, there's a lot of gay subtext going on here. That's what it's about. Plus, it's The Lost Boys, so it's the commentary on Peter Pan, one of my all-time favorite stories in the history of ever. Like, I'm a sucker.
Well, don't tell Rhea.
I love the Disney one's fine, but I'm saying like Peter Pan the book. She knows. Like, I have here on my shelf, I have a Tinkerbell. Like, Peter Pan's very important to me as a person. Like, it's one of my all-time favorite books. And so anytime there's a new Peter Pan version film, I'm going to see it. I'm just a fucking sucker for it. Like, you're going to call it The Lost Boys, I'm going to see it. You're going to call it, there was one called The Wendy last year. When I saw the trailer for it, before I even saw the movie, I saw the trailer, I got choked up. I like love Peter Pan so much. So for me, this plays in that too. It's like commenting on the Peter Pan trope and like the way, and that's where the Frog Brothers are, right? You know, they're the boys who are trying to play as adults. And then, you know, then there's the line that David Hess says, you'll never grow, you'll never die, which is obviously a Peter Pan-ish thing to say. So I found it incredibly fun. Like you said, Max, it's tongue in cheek, but it's satire. It's not like a laugh out loud, haha. It's not Life of Brian satire. It's like a Judge Dredd kind of satire where it's a little dark. It's a dark movie, but it's still poking at things. So I don't know. And this idea, you know, the way that boys are treated, the way that, like you mentioned right off the top, Dave, there's only one girl and there's one woman. So like, where are the women in this world? And so what are we commenting on there? So, I mean,
it's almost like Star Wars, isn't it?
Yes, that's well said. Yeah.
So I think the woman of the piece, there was one line in particular that made me laugh because it's pure exposition, but Sam is obviously scared of the closet monster and she sort of laughs and she says, but I think one of the reasons I divorced your father was because he never believed in the closet monster. It's like, yeah, it's fucking funny that, Mum. I'm still distraught, actually, over your painful divorce. Just thought it was a horrendous line. But it was obviously said as exposition to tell us, the audience, you know, the father hasn't died or anything. It's a divorce. I just thought I thought that was incredibly clumsy, to be honest. But maybe, if I tell you what you said, Tony, it's if I look at it through a satire type lens, then maybe I can forgive it.
She is thick as well, the mum, Lucy. She will. She is though. She will believe any old shite. Like she, you know, she falls for old Max's bullshit. The head vampire. She, you know, she doesn't notice what's going on under her nose with her own kids. You know. When she has Max round for dinner and Sam invites her Frog Brothers round to test Max out, she's just like oblivious to what's going on. Michael is slowly transitioning into a vampire and she's just like, we don't talk anymore, son. You know, what's going on? You can talk to me. It's like your son's turning into a fucking vampire. You know, wake up. She's literally one of the most dumb characters I've ever seen in a film.
Don't mix your words, Max. You know what? I like that because every time she comes back to her house, something's fucking trashed and destroyed and she just doesn't bat an eyelid. She must come home every night from the whole wherever they lived before and the house is wrecked. And she's like, oh, that damn just kids like, again.
For fuck's sake.
even when, like, I'm not trying to jump too far, even at the end, she's not like coming in going, oh my God, what's happened to my house? She's just like, oh no, what's all this mess? It's like, come on. That bit is a bit silly, I must admit. I must admit, that's so stupid. But I think with a character, because it's like she's trying to get on with her life, find this job, you know, make it better for the kids and stuff. It's difficult because obviously Jason Patrick, he must be about 25 when this is on and he's supposed to play some kid. You know what I mean? Like, he's a lot older than what he's supposed to be. I think Kiefer Sutherland I can buy, and the rest of the gang look like some fucking knockback 80s fucking heavy metal band that I've just got, you know, and like
Bill.
Some,
yeah, Bill, just, from, Bill from Bill and Ted is in there.
Yeah, Bill from Bill and yeah. Teddy's in there
oh
as well.
Oh, my God, what a mullet that is.
It's a classic. It's absolutely classic mullet. I agree with you, though, Max. I think, like, the where it's set is similar to a lot of 80s movies where it's like you've got this amazing beachfront, this, like, pier where everything happens, where these fairground rides, everything. I think it's really, it's set really well. I just found, like, I found there's nothing to the movie until like the last 15 minutes, which is good, to be fair. The end of it's good, but I just really struggled. I was expecting like to be like amazed again because when I first watched it, I was blown away because it's not my sort of film. And I was like, oh, I really enjoyed that. And this time it just felt like it aged badly for me. I don't know. I can't put my finger on it. And it wasn't like I was on my phone or I was messing about. I was fully in on watching it. I mean, Sam actually watched it together. And she said I've watched it a few times, so I don't know. I just came away going, all right, that's it. And even Kiefer Sutherland, when he meets his end, I was like, in the film these days, he'd come back and give him another go. But obviously, it's the 80s, and we've got 97 minutes, he's gone. You know, it's just very, very interesting how I saw it. I'm not the usual Chris Phelps, this is fucking shit, because it's not a shit film. But I just didn't grab me like I thought. But I was really looking forward to watching this as well.
I think maybe you're expecting an actual vampire movie as well.
Yeah.
I don't think it is. I think most of it, the reason I said about the homoerotic undertones, I mean, I think overtones. It's more about just, yeah, like it's not subtext, it's text.
Not at all.
You know, Michael, it's about him coming to terms with whether he wants to be part of the gang with the Lost Boys, the vampires kind of thing. And just, you know, he's conflicted about whether he wants to do that. So for me, the story was all about that. And actually, I probably feel the opposite to you, Chris, where I felt that was the most interesting piece. And then when it got to the big kind of fight and battle at the end, I kind of wasn't as interested then. I thought the interesting stuff was that journey of coming through and the interactions and everything.
It is definitely a character study. I mean, I think because again, 97 minutes. I mean, when you think about like 80s movies, 80s action movies, 97 minutes and you're out. Like the perfectly paced film, we can all agree, is Commando, right? Nothing in the world is better paced than Commando. If all films were made like Commando and they were 86 minutes and there was a Freddie Mercury guy at the end, perfect beginning to end, boom, in and out, right? I love
and
that.
And Chris movie. Fancies the kid as well.
Okay.
Fuck you. Yeah. In another film.
In another you. Film. 100%. But what the reason, so I think part of the issue is that it's like, because I think this is fascinating. Because I just listened to your Jaws episode today. So you talked about how the Jaws, I mean, it's the same thing. It's beat for beat. It's the same. It's a slow buildup. You see a gore thing at the beginning, and then it's a slow roller, and it's a slow roller, and you don't see the shark for a long time. And then when you kind of get a peek of it, and then at the end, it's a whole, you know, all hell breaks loose. But because it was 1977 instead of, or 1976 or whatever, instead of 1987, the expectations are different because it is all bright and colorful. And in those mullets, it's clearly a 1980s film with this different sensibility. So I think that's where the mishmash is coming. Like, where's Schumacher trying? He's living in this world where Commando and Predator are out. And he's giving us that, you know, he's giving us the spoonfuls of sugar, but he's still wanting to have the conversation about, like you said, who does Michael want to be with? Does he want to be a star? Or does he want to be with David? What's important to him? And, you know, and you're right. He's the character. And you said, Max, Kiefer read it as though David falls in love with Michael. Right. And I think that's really a fascinating read too. So maybe that's, you know, Kiefer was giving us that. So I get what you're saying, because your expectations are it's an over-the-top vampire movie, and it is. And that works. I think Max and I are on one side of this argument than you got. We're coming at this movie, I think, differently. And I think we have as the Frog Brothers. we're coming at it that way. But I think
you need
that's
a much
really,
deeper voice to be one
sorry,
of those.
I'm a Gerard Allen Frog. I mean, so much so I know Max and I both watched the two follow-up Lost Boys movies.
Oh, fuck me. Two of the worst films you will ever see.
You know what? We watched them both.
Oh, yeah. What? I felt like okay. I had to. I felt like I had to.
So that says everything about where we are, because we both watched The Tribe and The Thirst, which feature the Frog Brothers prominently. And yeah, so I don't know. I just rambled. Sorry, but I do agree with what I hear what you guys are both saying, Chris and Dave, but I just feel like, and I get what you, Dave, I'm with you. I think the character study is the fascinating piece, but I also love that it turns batshit on its end because I love Schumacher does that. He goes crazy. Like, I mean, I know everybody hates the bat nipples, but I gotta say, everybody knew the assignment in Batman and Robin. Everybody knew what it was. You may not like what it was, but it was exactly the movie that I think Schumacher wanted to make. It was the last 15 minutes of this movie, but for 2 hours.
You know, I still remember Chris and I, you know, we watched Batman Forever, and it was only a couple of years ago, I think, and we watched it and we're like, you know what? This is actually pretty good. You know, maybe we should go back to Batman and Robin, and maybe that's not as bad as well. Yeah, that didn't end well.
No, that's fucking shit.
It was as terrible as we remember.
But it didn't have any of this stuff. It was all that last 15 minutes of mania in a 20-minute movie where Batman Forever does this. You spend time, he sulks, he's moody, he does all the stuff, he's building his character, where they're like, okay, you didn't like that. Everybody's saying Batman Forever sucks. Let's give you Batman and Robin, which is nonstop, crazy adrenaline, motorcycle chases and bullshit for 2 hours, and everybody hates that too. So it's like, okay, and you know, plus Schwarzenegger. So I don't know. I'm here to defend Schumacher. That's all I'm saying.
One thing I wanted to ask all you guys is, and it's when rewatching it, about Max and how Max is revealed at the end to be the head vampire all along. When you watch it back, knowing what's coming at the end, all the clues are there every time he's on screen. But it's hard to think back to when you watched it originally. Did you see that coming, or was that for you guys like a massive, like, oh my God, I really did not see that twist?
I didn't see it coming because, I mean, there was something off about him. But, I mean, like you say, the mum's a little bit ditzy, isn't she? So the fact that she lets this douchebag into their lives wasn't a massive surprise. But I didn't really understand why, when they did all the tests, you know, they could see his reflection and stuff. I thought that discounted him as a candidate for being the head vampire. So I don't know, how did he get away with that?
He was invited in.
Yeah, when he comes to the house, right. he says to Michael, doesn't he, I shan't come in unless you invite me. And then he goes, you're invited, and he comes in. In vampire lore, if you invite a vampire into your house, you are powerless to do anything to them, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that validates your question, really. So you were saying all the clues are there. You've watched it lots of times. So it's like Sixth Sense, isn't it? You watch it the second time, you're like, it was right there, and just completely missed it. So I fell for it because I, like I say, you couldn't see his reflection or anything. So I was like, right, it's not him, it's someone else. And because it's been so long, you know, it's on the order of 30 years or so, you know, I'd just completely forgotten about it.
Yeah.
It is just ask a question there, Matt, because, and you can correct me here, but this does seem like, obviously, you know the lore with the vampires, but we're almost in Mike Burton territory of Star Wars, of unless you know what's going on in the background, none of it makes sense. Because is that even mentioned in the movie? Because is it? Oh, right. Well, that's me who wasn't paying attention then.
Yeah. at the end, when he actually does reveal himself to be the head vampire, because obviously after David gets killed and they're like, oh, we haven't changed back. Oh, shit. So who's the head vampire? And then he reveals. And one of the kids says to him, but we did this and we did that. And he's like, oh, he says, you stupid boy or something. Don't you know, if you invite a vampire into your house, then, you know, such things don't work or something like that.
Yeah. No, sorry. He did say that. Because I must admit, when they're doing the test, when I first watched, I think you had a good question there, Max. I was genuinely like, oh, he is the fucking baddie. You know, because he seemed a bit too nice. He didn't seem that scared of what was going on, did he? He was just sort of there, getting with like the mum and everything, you know, like the midwives. Well, I'm going to say he's older than all of us, really, because he looks about 60. But again, when he turns into the vampire, he's got to be one of the dodgiest bad guys ever. I mean, he's a big guy, and he must be about 6'4". So obviously he's taller than everyone, but the fight is pretty shit. And obviously he dispatches Michael like he's a little kid, but then Michael can somehow pick him up with superhuman strength and then railroad him onto these spikes. You know, he's a bit... not far fetched, but I'm not buying that because Kiefer Sutherland gave Michael an absolute bit of a shoeing, really. He just sort of took him out by mistake. However, that scene with Kiefer Sutherland is amazing because it's the slowest flying scene I've ever seen in any movie. And I think it's about the homoerotic. These two are literally just going to get it on at that point before he throws him into the spike. So
when you're saying the two sweaty men grappling, thrusting themselves against wall that has a bunch of phallic devices, phallic objects sitting out of the side. What? Are you sure?
Look, I know I like wrestling, but there's no need to just bring
I thought you were describing the wrestling, to be honest. I was surprised. I thought, you know, the old sax player, Tim Capello there, right? He looks like a wrestler, doesn't he?
He does.
Absolutely built like a brick shit house.
He's Tina Turner's saxophonist, right, Max?
He was, yeah. I mean, yeah. She's retired. She's retired now. But
all through
the 80s and 90s, he was her sax player in her live band. Yeah, he's like a serious session musician, big time, yeah.
Yeah, and yet somehow that's why he has all the time to work out, because that's what he does. He shows up, he plays the sax, and he hits the gym. That's all he does. And he spends and all his money on oil.
Yeah, yeah.
So oiled up.
Yeah, funnily enough, next weekend in Manchester, there's a massive horror movie convention on, and our mutual friend John Hammond's going to it, I think, with his wife. And Tim Capello is appearing at the horror convention. He's obviously doing...
Chris, you're going to be there.
Yeah. Oh, shit, yeah. Is he still in that shape?
No, he's not now. No. I mean, he's pushing 70 now. I mean, he still looks good. He's still got the hair and everything. But he's not quite in that kind of shape. He'd be a very brave man to take his top off now, shall we say, you know. I think he'd look more like me with his top off than he did in 1987. But at this convention, obviously, he's going to do signing and pictures like they all do. But he is actually going to perform this song live at the convention next week.
Oh, my God.
Well. So, yeah, I know. Can you imagine?
Be mega that. Whereabouts in Manchester is that one, Mike? Is that at Bowlers?
At Bowlers, yeah.
Oh my gosh,
yeah,
less than a mile weekend, away. Yeah.
I think you got to go, Chris. I think you need to get some press credentials.
Get yourself down there. Yeah, John Hammond will be there, so get yourself down there, yeah.
Yeah, you should do. If I was up, I'd definitely go down there. But should we feel old collectively now?
Sure.
I was just looking up that, so Edward Herman, who plays Max, would have been 44 when this was shot.
Wow. I am 49.
So right in our ballpark.
Yeah.
Wow.
He must have had a hard life.
Yeah.
We just watched The Gilmore Girls, and he's in that. He's the dad in The Gilmore Girls. So he is a monster of a man. Like, it's always funny when he's on screen in that too, because he's so towers over. It's like, I don't even know how they frame the shots. It's the same in this, because Diane Wiest is such a small little woman. And so there's a couple of those that are almost like, that was, maybe the casting director should have done something different. But yeah, wow, 44.
Unbelievable.
I don't know. I'm 49. So you guys would tell me, right? I mean, is this what this is about? Is this an intervention?
It's weird, isn't it, though? It's like Marita being younger than Ralph Macchio is now in Cobra Kai when the first Karate Kid was done. As you look back at it, it's very, very weird, isn't it? But what I will just say as well, I said at the start, my impression of Kiefer Sutherland was probably shaped by watching this movie. And you watch things after this, like Flatliners and stuff, and you're a fucking douchebag. I have to say, watching it this time, I was like, for a vampire, he seems all right, really. He's got the hots for Michael. All right. But, you know, he didn't seem that bad for a vampire. And I just wonder where my perception of him was shaped, really. I don't know if it's just me. I just didn't think he was that bad.
I think he's brilliant in this. He was very young here. Kiefer Sutherland is barely out of his teens here, and he's so charismatic at this age. You know, he owns the screen, and he barely speaks as well. You know, when you think about it, he says more than the other Lost Boys. They basically don't speak. The other three guys just kind of stand in the background, rocking the mullet, but. In terms of like the leading men and women in this film, he probably says less than all of them, really. But even at this age, he was a really big screen presence, I think.
Yeah, it was always a swing and miss for me that off of the back of this, that nobody was like, you are going to play John Constantine. It was just a shame. It was always a shame to me that, you know, it's like if you couldn't get Sting to do it, because that's who they base Constantine on. It's like, Kiefer Sutherland standing right there. I know he's a good actor. I'm sure he can do a British accent. Let's get it done. So that was always a swing and a miss for me that they didn't get him as Constantine.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's just part of vampire lore. You say about being invited in somewhere, but it was actually a TV movie. It was done in two parts, Stephen King based. One of the things that shit me up good and proper as a kid, 100%. And I will never forget that scene where he's just scratching on the window. And my God, that was responsible for so many sleepless nights and nightmares. And so when David's at the window, when Michael's at the window saying, let me in, it just gave me those real Salem's Lot vibes.
I would like to have you guys watch that, because it does not hold up. I think all of your fear will be dissuaded. I don't believe it holds up. Plus, just to make Chris watch a shit movie would always be fun.
Sam actually said an hour before we recorded, you got to watch Salem's Lot. She went, I'm actually going to become a Patreon just to fucking make you watch it when you can fry it off. I'll refuse your Patreon. You're not doing it. Not watching it.
I watched about 7 minutes on YouTube, and I was still waiting for what was going to happen. Just almost nothing happened at all. But it's just that scene. The only thing I remember is just the kid scratching at the window. That was it, you know. And if you think about it, a lot of movies back then, it was just about these very short moments in movies. I think we have higher expectations now that a movie is going to grab your attention for the whole time. Whereas I think a lot of movies, when we go back and watch, it's like, yeah, there's about 10 good minutes in this, and that's it.
True. That's true.
Has anyone got any other points they want to make, unless we go into our...
I just would like to mention the love of the Coreys. What is crazy, I think we'd be remiss to not mention the fact that this movie is part of this. There was a stretch in time with the Coreys, Haim and Feldman, were in like every other movie together. And they were like two of the biggest stars. And both of them were totally and literally, in some cases, fucked over. And it's just kind of sad to think about how talented.
Did you really go there?
I did. It's true, though. It's literal. Corey Feldman talks about it. It's awful. It's horrific what happened to them. And you go back and you see this film, and they're both having a blast. And they're, you know, because you see Corey Haim do other stuff. I mean, Feldman's the better actor of the two of them. But it's insane to me to go back and watch this. And it was like, so I love this film for all those things, but I just thought it would be remiss to not mention that these were like teen stars at the height of their powers. And you can see why on the screen. You see what they can do, because I've seen probably 30 of their movies, you know, because they were like for 10 years, they were in everything. And they're always good. They're always bringing their A game. They always know the assignment. And so I would be remiss to say like this, it's kind of like with The Outsiders, you know, like this is like a horror version of The Outsiders. Like you see this incredible cast that goes on to do these other things, and like the people who, you know, you wouldn't think anything of, you know, have gone, you know, it's Jason Patrick and Kiefer Sutherland's movie, but these two kids break out from here and become huge stars. And, you know, and I just thought we'd be remiss not to mention the Coreys. And it is, I wasn't trying to be flippant there, Dave. I'm sorry if it came across that way. I mean, literally their lives were ruined. And it's just so bizarre to think that, you know, they were in the spotlight. They were on the cover of every Tiger Beat magazine and everything. And yet, you know, their lives got turned upside down. So, you know, I almost think they're a cautionary tale for the next generation of kid actors too. Like they kind of paved the way so other kids don't have to go through the same stuff they went through too. But it's impressive that they pulled all this off while going through such personal turmoil.
What's up with the puns? I was thinking, do I bring it up? Because there's obviously a lot of that negative stuff. No, it's okay. I'm used to it. Chris normally does it. I just wasn't expecting you to do it. No, that's awesome. Like you say, the light shone on them very brightly for a good time in the 80s and early 90s, didn't it?
Yeah. And they're great in this. I think they're both great.
Yeah. Fantastic. Any final points, Max?
Yeah, I think just an extension of what Tony's saying, really. I think pretty much every performance in this is pretty good. I don't think there's any... I mean, some people have got a lot more to do than others, but I don't think there's any performance here you look at and go, my God, dash. When you look at back over a lot of older films, especially cult films, you can say, oh, the acting's terrible or whatever. But I think the acting's really good. I think it's a really good ensemble cast Joel Schumacher put together for this film. I think everyone's really well cast. I mean, everyone's good looking from top to bottom, except maybe Max and Edna and Lucy, I suppose. But everyone else is handsome or pretty. And it's just a really good, well-made film that's nice to look at. Great music, you know, more of which to come next week. And just, it's just a really fun time, I think. It doesn't take itself too seriously. It's a good, you know, comedy horror film. And it's a fun time, I think.
Awesome. Well, with that, should we get into our final review?
Let's go.
Right, so, Mr. Max Byrne, what did you think of this one? And then do you guys need the scores, or have you listened to it enough to go, we know where we're going with this one, Chris?
Just remind me of the first two. Sorry, Chris.
Not the bottom two, Max?
No.
We knew from the beginning where Max is.
No.
So I'll go from the top and the bottom to the top then, Max. So if it's the worst thing you've ever seen, it gets shot off to Alderaan, never to be seen again. If it's still a dodgy movie, but, you know, not as bad, it's Elm Street. If it's in the middle, it's Hill Valley. If it's a great film, but just not top tier, it's Pleasantville. And if it's the best thing you've ever seen, like No Treat, No Surrender 3, it is Cloud City.
Wow. Like No Treat, No Surrender 3, Max.
Well, I mean, let's get real. Nothing can come close to No Retreat, No Surrender 3. Not even No Treat, No Surrender 2. Maybe
I bow to you, Max.
Maybe one. But no, that aside, I'm going to put this... Do you know what? I'm going to stick it in Cloud City right up there with No Retreat, No Surrender 3. Because to me, it's just... It reminds me of being young, which I suppose, you know, that's kind of the theme of the film, being a forever young. It reminds me of a younger time in my life and it, you know, when life was easier. It's just a good, fun film. It doesn't take itself too seriously. It's got some great one-liners in as well, lots of quotable
Death
dialogue.
Death by stereo,
yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's got larger-than-life characters. The Frog Brothers, like I said earlier, two of my favourite film characters of all time and always will be. It's very well made. Joel Schumacher is a very accomplished filmmaker. For all the shit films he made, he also made some fantastic films in his CV. Very varied bunch of films. So very talented guy when all said and done. Despite, you know, it's a great film. Despite the fact that the two sequels it eventually spawned are two of the biggest pieces of shit I've ever seen in my life, this still stands up for me as one of the quintessential 80s films. I think when, you know, you get to see polls of the greatest 80s films ever made, this always is in the mix. I'm not saying it's the greatest film of the 80s, because let's get real, it's not. But it's always in the mix in this conversation when they do these charts. It's always mentioned. And I just defy anyone to watch it and not have a good time. It doesn't take so seriously. It's quite lightweight when all said and done, but a great watch. So for me, yeah. All the way in, top draw, straight in at the top, Cloud City, please.
I expected that, Max, I must admit. What about yourself, Tony?
I'm going to have to echo almost everything Max said. I think the thing is, and again, and not to be a downer, and I'm sorry, everybody, that I brought that thing about the Corys, but that's the thing, the reason the sequels got made, the first sequel, which is The Tribe, right, Max, and then The Thirst comes after that, was because Corey Haim was in such bad shape. You know, his life, he never really rebounded from some of the stuff. And again, that was kind of what I was trying to bring up, is like, here he is at the time going through some serious shit that a lot of those 80s kids actors, and he's still turning in a great performance. And he gets to say Death by Stereo and he's smiling and, you know, giving us a great performance in this film. So for me, you know, like, while those sequels are bad, man, we both watched them, of course, but it was like, they needed to do it to try to get him some money, to get him some help. And so it's, that's sad, and I'm not trying to bring the show to a screeching halt again, but what I'm saying is, it's nice to go back and see the talent that he had on display here, and even though he is in that suck ball of a movie, and its sequel, which, Max, we both watched The Tribe, and then watched The Thirst anyway. What's wrong with us?
I don't know. I just must have felt like like punishing myself that time of my life. I don't know. I should have learned my lesson, because it wasn't going to get any better, was it?
It was not going to get any. Well, no, because the second one, the frog, it's all the frogs. The Thirst is the Frog Brothers movie. So anyway, I'm going to put it right up there too, because of all of those things. Amazing performances. These are guys, everybody's firing on all cylinders. Everybody's great. And I think, I mean, Diane Weiss and Edward Herrmann are great actors, and they're giving the performance they're supposed to give. Diane Weiss is an Oscar-winning actor. She's playing dumb. Like, the fact that Max go on and on about how dumb she is, that's because she's good. Like, we didn't even talk about the grandpa. That guy's hysterical. He steals every scene he's in. So it can't be anywhere but Cloud City. It is not perfect, but it is exactly like rewatching it again. 14-year-old me just was like, man, I remember why I love this so much. So Cloud City here too.
Excellent. Excellent. I can't argue with that.
Now Chris is going to shit on our hearts, Max. He's going to rip them out and show us them while they're still beating.
It wouldn't be a VHS Strikes Back without some controversy. So for me, I didn't enjoy it like I thought I would. I thought it was quite boring. I thought, I must admit, I just think it's aged pretty badly. And I think last 10, 15 minutes, I was all in on. I think Max is right. Great saying. Where it is, I think, like we talked about that. I think the music, which I'm looking forward to going through next week, is good. The Jim Morrison stuff, it almost felt like we were watching For Your Height Only, because they just kept playing People Are Strange all the time. But
hey, they paid for it.
Yeah, they obviously paid for it. And there's a picture of Jim Morrison as well, which wasn't really explained, but we'll obviously talk about that next week. So I'm going to send it to Elm Street, because I just don't think I'm going to watch it again. And I was really upset that I didn't enjoy it. And it's not a case of I've came into it blind because I've never seen it before, which when we've covered it, as you know, we cover these ones and then I'm like, well, this is rubbish because I've never seen this crap before. I have no love for it, you know, but yeah, so I just felt it just wasn't for me, unfortunately. So yeah, Elm Street, and probably the lowest score of the four. Well, they am the lowest score of the four. So I do apologize, gentlemen, because you love it so much.
It's okay. We still love you, Chris. It doesn't matter. We're not mad. We don't take it personally. We didn't make the movie.
So I think for me, I have gone so many years without watching this. I was really quite surprised how the story went. I was kind of expecting, you know, this dark vampire story and very much the vampires to be central to it, but I didn't. I found it more about kind of moving somewhere new and fitting in. So we've seen this story lots of times before, and yeah, right at the end it lost me a bit. I didn't really care for that. I cared more about the characters and everything. I did wonder if, you know, it was intentional to have Patrick's character as Michael when he had the David Hasselhoff do. You know, it was great. I always wanted hair like that, but I could just never get it to stay in place. But no, I really, really enjoyed it. And like you say, there is charisma oozing out of the screen. Everyone is just playing a really good role. And it is obviously hammed up a bit, you know, but it's intentional as well. And I just really enjoyed this. And I introduced my kids to it. And I said to them, right, from now, every month, you're going to watch a classic movie with me. So I'll try not to make it crap. So we watched that. I made them watch Aliens as well. Ooh. So they, you know, they actually did like that. And the endorsement they gave it was, well, it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be, which for a, you know, for kids, teenagers, that is a ringing endorsement. So, I was quite happy with that. And, you know, we'll obviously cover this in our other podcast, but I thought the music was absolutely fantastic. You're never too far away from an absolute classic song. So for me, it's not quite in the upper echelons of great movies, but definitely a Pleasantville. Really, really solid movie for me.
Well, you are the first to hear about this before it comes out. So next, thank you as well, both of you, for coming on. I really appreciate it. Honestly, we both do. Next week's show, we have a pick by Herb, one of our Patreons. Now, we've done the first one in this series. We've jumped the second one and we've gone straight to the third. So I'm going to put this one on because we all know what this is. So are you ready for this one, gentlemen?
Oh, God.
Yep.
The time has come when a student must question.
I know you don't believe in fighting, but this isn't exactly fighting, you know?
Yep.
Not exactly ping pong either.
When a teacher must let go.
Yagi always train you, but for tournament, cannot.
When a conspiracy is planned.
You said that if I beat this LaRusso kid in the All Valley tournament, that you give me 25% of your new dojo.
When a trap is set.
You know how to front sweep?
Not really. Do you know how to sweep?
Of course. Or like this. And left the side.
Right. It's no joke.
I need your title. You don't enter? That affects my financial future, Daniel. Get it? You think you can rely on that crane crap?
Last time you weren't fighting this.
Mr. Miyagi loves you. He has faith in you.
This guy wants to break you. Humiliate you. Stomp you into the ground.
Yes! I'm sorry if you don't like it, but I got problems, and if you're not going to be part of the solution, don't give me a hard time about it.
Now, the man must make a choice, and the kid must become a man.
You are going to defend. You're getting
how young Terry
what am I doing?
No. First he suffers, then he suffers some more.
Ralph Macchio, Pat Morita, a John G. Avildsen film, The Karate Kid, Part 3.
Wow.
Wow.
Oh, yes.
So you probably know this, Max and Tony, but the best thing is that Terry Silver, in real life, he's playing, well, in film he's playing, he's 20 years older, that I think Griffith, who plays him. He's actually younger than Ralph Macchio in this movie, but he's playing a Vietnam veteran, which is just the strange, we know that from Cobra Kai, don't we? Because they've said like he's younger than him, but it's the strangest thing ever because how young he is. So, what a film. And we've not done the second one because I always like the third one. I never liked the second one as much. But
the second one where they go to Japan. I really like the second one.
And I've just finished actually watching Cobra Kai this weekend. So quite apt that we're doing this one because I've really enjoyed the new series again. You know,
I've never watched Cobra Kai. It's on the list. You guys.
One of the best hundreds of books.
You got to choose. I choose books over other stuff. I know I'm the worst. I'm sorry. But
Make time. Each episode is only about half an hour. Odd moments here and there. Watch it.
I will. Yeah. Here's the thing.
So good.
I actually am going to say, and I'll just put this on there because I will not be on with you next week. I actually love the next Karate Kid with Hilary Swank. I saw it in the theater on opening day. I'm that guy. You guys go ahead. Make fun. I did not like the third one. I loved the next one. So I'm that guy.
Oh, my word.
That's Blasphemy.
Yeah, that's shocking. I mean, I'm with Max on this, Tony. Honestly, Cobra Kai, he's got his bit of cheese in it and that, but he's got all the 80s nostalgia that you would
And didn't
love.
Elizabeth Shue show back up in
oh,
it?
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
everyone,
so good.
Everyone who's not dead from the original films has shown up by now.
Did you know that Pat Morita got nominated for Best Supporting Actor for the original Karate Kid?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. Well,
brilliant.
Well, I can't wait to hear you guys talk. That's exciting. So you're done with the horror month and you're moving on to.
Yes. Going into November and I have a movie up my sleeve in a few weeks, which will take us right back down. Jaws was a high point. I've got one ready and rolling. That's going to be a low point, but he's still not going to be necromantic. So anyway, big thank you.
Spider-Dad. He's never living that shit down.
Never ever. It was the worst thing ever.
It makes me feel good that you hated that more than Tinker. Like you'd watch Tinker all day long.
Yeah. Oh, all day long and twice on Sunday, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I'm getting fucking sweats now thinking about that piece of shit. But anyway, massive thank you to Tony and Max for coming on. Where can everyone get you guys on social media, Tony?
I am off the social medias just for my own well-being, but I have a website, arfarina.com. You can send me messages there. And of course, where you find me the most, if you just subscribe to Comics in Motion P, because I'm part of the Comics in Motion family with my good friend, Max Byrne, we host Mandatory Music and CD, which is a joy. Once a month, we do a classic album, and we've had a blast. You'll be guesting with us soon, Chris. And obviously, I'm an indie comic spotlight. I'm a pop gorilla. I do Season's Greetings with Jack, all inside the Comics in Motion. If you subscribe to Comics in Motion, you'll hear me probably at least once a week, sometimes more. Sorry.
What about yourself, Max? That's great.
I'm on Twitter at Maxi Byrne, MaxyByrne. If you go there, there's links to the various websites I write articles and reviews for. Check them out. And like Tony said, at Comics in Motion P, where you'll find our music show. And I can't wait for you to come on, Chris, next week, where we dissect the wonderful soundtrack to go with this wonderful film we've just discussed.
got a feeling I'm going to like the soundtrack more, Max, than the movie. But no, thank you, guys. Honestly, it's been so good, and I'm really looking forward to it. And also, if you want to contact us, guys, please email us at vhsstrikesback@gmail.com. Follow us on some social media at vhsstrikesback. And if you want to support us, get over to patreon.com/vhsstrikesback, like Mr. Tony Farina does. So our roll call of honour today is Trent, Dan, Justin, Susan, Timothy, Alec, Paul, Matt, Heath, Dylan, Ken, Lucky Lulu Green, Herb, Jax, Math Blake, John Hammond, and Mr. Tony Farina. So thank you very much, sir, for your support. We do appreciate everyone who supports us, past and present, and across all social media, all our friends on there. So good. And what I've just realised is Comics in Motion P, as the co-creator of Comics in Motion P, you guys are actually on that feed more than I am currently at the moment, which we are going to be rectifying very soon.
The last thing you did was like, we're even going to play the trailer for Eternals, and then nothing, then crickets. So it's like, you're like, I believe you even said on the Doctor Strange show, I'm going to throw my flag, I'm going to plant my flag in the sand, we're doing it next week, and then...
I've got loads to say about Eternals, because I watched half of it and I was like, holy shit, this is bad. This is fucking terrible. The fucking hokey way that they just pass off the whole Thanos fucking destroying the earth and that, and the snap of the fingers is utter horseshit. So I really think I need to get back in the saddle. Oh my God, that is a fucking terrible movie. You've got me going now, Tony. That's it. I'll be ringing Dave saying we need to record this. But no, we are, I promise we are going to get back on that, because it's... No, I should maybe do something. It's just the fucking reality TV stuff on the CD reality cast is just ridiculous. Like, we're doing podcasts nearly 2 or 3 times a day now, me and Dave. It's just ridiculous. How we've never fell out, I do not know. But anyway,
you don't live in the same house.
probably. But no, thank you both. And obviously, as I said, next week's Karate Kid 3. Big thank you to all of you for listening in, guys, as always. And we will see you next time. So it's bye from me.
Bye.
I'm gonna do a...
Bye.
Bye now.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over. What the fuck are we gonna do now?
What are we gonna do?
Maybe we could build a fire, sing a couple of songs, huh? Why don't we try that?
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
I'll be back.
That's odd.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
Wax on, wax off.
Ah! Ah! Get to the chopper!
One ring to go.
All right. Ding, ding.
Bust you up.
Go for it.
Well, here we go.
Ain't so bad. Ain't so bad. Ain't so bad. Ain't so bad. Ain't nothing.
You must be crazy or something.
I'm crazy.
You're just a stupid
fool. Yeah, maybe you're stupid.
You're crazy.
I ain't breathing heavy.
He's a fool. He's stupid.
I've seen you in 6 months.